Yes, we are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It's called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. John Wall doesn't need no introduction. It's an insider's look at the NBA and culture surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick of the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on the hottest topics in the league. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com. One place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
L-A-S-I-K, LASIK.com.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
The I Am Rappaport Stereo Podcast. Live.
You down with Rappaport? Yes, I am. Down with Rappaport? Yes, I am. Down with Rappaport? Yes, I am. Down with Rappaport? Yes, I am.
You better tune in, iamrappaport.com. Cause every single podcast, you know he drops bombs. I seen him on set, a seasoned vet with true talent. Catch him on his way to CrossFit, rocking the New Balance. He asked me to do the track cause he know I rhyme elite. But I'm just waiting for the Robert De Niro line of the week. Breakfast of Champions, toasted bagel, cream cheese and lox. This is I Am Rappaport, the show never stops. You might catch him out in public, stretching his knees. But if you don't listen to the show, yo, wigga please.
Wigga please.
This is the Podcast.
What's up? This is Michael Rappaport. You are now listening to the I Am Rappaport Stereo Podcast. On today's podcast, it is a all wild, wild country I Am Rappaport Stereo Podcast. I have the directors of the Netflix documentary series Wild Wild Country, which I am obsessed with. If you haven't seen it, I cannot recommend it any stronger. It's bugged out. It's crazy. It's wild. It takes twists and turns. I happened upon this six-hour docu-series, which is on Netflix. Again, it's called Wild Wild Country. Today, I have the directors, two brothers, Chapman Way and McLean Way. We're talking about the making of this film, what happened now since the making of the film, what it takes to actually make a documentary, the dedication, the ground and pound, all that and more coming up on a brand new Wild Wild Country I Am Rappaport Stereo Podcast. Miles Jordan. Let me get something real funky. Let's just jump into this. Okay. I'm so excited to have you guys here. I think the listeners who are going to listen are excited because this is the Wild Wild Country I Am Rappaport Stereo Podcast with the Way Brothers.
We're here. Thanks for having us on, man.
Oh, man. Come on, man. I'm excited. The directors of Wild Wild Country, I'll say the newest Netflix documentary series that is sort of sweeping the nation. You know, I mean, it's, you know, and I know you guys, you know, you're humble about it, but I mean, it's really caught on. It was just released. I talked a lot about this film on the podcast right after I saw it because I was just like, what the fuck? And, you know, it's hard to articulate really what the movie's about because it's so long and it covers so much and it's, and I was just so enthusiastic when I saw it. And, you know, to be honest, to have you guys here, one of the beautiful things about a podcast is, and the internet is like, you know, and you know, having some sort of success and a Netflix show, I was like, I love this movie. And I was like, wait a minute, I got to fucking try to get these guys on the podcast. So this is the first sort of time I've done this, and it's two brothers. So
that's awesome. Well, thanks for having us on. We wanted to love talking about it. I mean, this is something that we spent like 4 years of our life kind of making. It's like you kind of have to be obsessive about these types of stories. I think that like people are always like, oh, you guys might be tired of talking about it, but I don't know, we love coming on these things, especially podcasts like face to face. You can really like dive in and talk about stuff, and it's been crazy because we made this thing just in a bedroom at Mark Duplass's office in Highland Park, and so it felt like so small for so long. And then when it goes on Netflix, like globally, you get the kind of an immediate reception. It's been pretty incredible.
Has the response been sort of overwhelming? Like, I mean, I guess, you know, when you're making it in someone's bedroom and it's the grind, the ground and pound really, of making docs, you know, your first doc seemed tough, but this just seemed like even tougher.
Yeah. Well, you've made it, Doc. I mean, just to even get it to a point where the documentary makes sense is a huge hurdle. I mean, 90% just goes into making sure, like, can people follow the story? And then to, like, really put in the extra time to really, like, make it entertaining, make it thoughtful, provocative. It was a real grind for us. It took us about 4 years to do.
How did you come about the story?
Yeah.
And I'm going to mispronounce Rajneesh.
Rajneesh.
I practice early, and I'm going to mispronounce names, so please correct me every time I do. How did the origins of making this as a film
in our lives
come about?
So our first documentary was on the Battered Bastards of Baseball, a minor league baseball team in Portland, Oregon. And so we had just wrapped that up in 2014, and we worked with a film archivist who gave us the footage for the Portland Mavericks. And he was asking us, you know, what are you guys doing next for your project? And Mac and I had a couple ideas, but nothing we were like too in love with. And he basically said, like, look, I've got this collection of 300 hours of archive footage on pretty much what is like the most batshit crazy story that ever happened in Oregon. And so he started telling us it was about this guru and these 10,000 followers that came here from India. They built this $120 million utopian city. They took over the neighboring town of Antelope. They armed themselves with assault rifles and bussed in thousands of homeless people and ended up poisoning 750 people.
We were almost questioning him more than the story.
We had never heard of any of this. So we're like, there's no way this is true or that this happened in America, because we would have for sure have known about this story. And sure enough, we kind of went back and did some light Googling, and everything he had told us had happened. And so that was about 4 years ago, and we just immediately dove in.
Yeah, it was one of those things, too, where I think after Battered Bastards had come out, we totally made that on our own, independently, financed it entirely ourselves, won a sports grant to make that, like $30,000, and we got it into Sundance, which was just huge for us in our careers, and showed it at Sundance, and Netflix was just... They had been doing streaming for a while, but like House of Cards had like just come out. And so Netflix,
when
the baseball premiered at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival.
Right. It's changed. So, I mean, it's
today you would not need to explain like what a Netflix original is.
But
back then you kind of did.
Right.
Need
back
to.
Then, it was 3 years ago.
Right. Exactly. That's how much it's changed.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And so Netflix was at Sundance and they bought the Battered Bastards of Baseball. And so right after that was when this story came into our life, and we were kind of getting pitched for the first time. And what we were getting pitched was almost always sports docs, if not baseball documentaries. Mm. And we're huge sports fans and love baseball.
But enough is enough.
But yeah.
Especially after you finish the first doc.
Absolutely. We just wanted to do something differently because we see ourselves as documentary filmmakers. We want to continue to make documentaries, and we didn't just want to, I love 30 for 30s, but I didn't just want to do that. And so this story came along and it was complex and sensational, and it had all these what the fuck moments in it. But at the underbelly too was like some interesting complex topics that we were interested in diving in. Difference between a cult and a religion, minority religious rights, immigration bias, things like that, making, you know, even to people that look like redneck bigots, really listening to them and understanding what their experience was like in this story. And so for us, what was interesting is like The Jinx had like just come out on HBO. But this was still pre-Making a Murder. OJ Made in America hadn't come out yet. Like, doc series were still kind of this new emerging thing, but we knew that we had to tell this as a series. And so that was a big jump for us, though.
How old are you guys?
I'm 31.
I'm 27.
Okay. All right. You have to excuse me, because I'm going to jump all over the place.
No problem.
And like I said, I'm really fucking excited. And, you know, there's so much ground to cover in my questions. And I've never done this. I even went on my Twitter and asked if people had questions. So throughout this interview, I'm going to sort of put it all together.
Sure.
So what was the first 15, 20, half an hour minutes of film of this archival footage that you saw that you were like, oh shit.
Yeah.
First, do you remember first?
Absolutely.
There was kind of two tapes that really stood out. The first one was when the Bhagwan first arrives in Portland. And we put in this tape and we see all these people dressed head to toe in red with a mala of the picture of the guru around their neck. And they're rolling out this red carpet in the middle of downtown Portland. And they're got out a dustbuster and they started vacuuming the carpet, the red carpet, and then started placing flowers down. And then there was a flutist. They had a live flutist that was playing. And then coming around the corner is this $100,000 Rolls Royce, pulls up, and this Indian guru walks out with this
3-foot beard.
3-foot beard, this huge gown. And they immediately start bowing and praying to him, and tears start coming down the faces of the followers. And so Mac and I were immediately just like, this is incredible. What is going on here? You know? And that blew us away. The second tape that we then put in was their World Festival. Every year they had this World Festival
1983
where thousands of followers from all around the world would come. And it's like this insane Burning Man meets Coachella. They're river rafting. They're dancing naked. They're throwing these rave parties.
Yeah, but I remember thinking like, oh, it looks like they've built a city in the middle of the Oregon Desert. Like that
this
was
is
what,
before
this
you,
is before I even knew anything. Like before I even, I just saw the tapes and it was, I couldn't even say Rajneeshpuram. I was like, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like I was coming to it for the first time too. And it was just, I remember my instincts being like, how many people are there? And it looked like 7,000 to 8,000 at the World Festival. Cause these Rajneeshis would come from all over the world. But then my next thing was, like I said, it was like, have they built all of this out there? And then basically, yeah, started Googling around. And everything that that archivist had told us started checking out. There was this town takeover of Antelope. They busted homeless people. 751 people were poisoned with salmonella. And then the next step that really kind of got us going full steam ahead was when we started reaching out to kind of more than just like our talking heads. They're more like our cast of characters, you know? They're kind of like the storytellers that are on the front lines of this war that breaks out in Eastern Oregon.
More specifically, Sheila.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as you turn the footage...
Did you know first, like, that's the first
person? She was the first person going through the archive footage. I mean, she was provocative. She was foul-mouthed. She cussed. She didn't take shit from anyone. She was just this really dynamic female leader of this group. And so we thought, wow, what a fascinating, complex character. We've got to hear kind of what it was like for her to go through this journey.
Okay, I want to get to Sheila, but I got to back up with the fucking Rolls Royce. Because you know, the Rolls, like this movie, this documentary film, this series that you put out, while I was watching it, I was very, like, I was watching it on the edge of my seat and I was pissed off at both sides. Like, like, there was many times. One of the things that pissed me off from the beginning was his fucking Rolls Royces. Because in my opinion, I'm like, if you're a spiritual guru you have all these followers, forget a Honda Accord, forget a Volvo, forget even a BMW. Right. To be a spiritual guru with an obsession with Rolls Royces, the dichotomy, it just doesn't make any sense. Sure. Like in this day and age, like if you saw like some spiritual, we'd be able to document, be like, oh, we're looking at this fancy home. It's like one of these preachers, you know, like
totally. It begs the question, like, is this a con? Like, I get
like,
that.
What is like, this? Yeah, you're a spiritual guru, but you got fucking $100,000 Rolls Royce. And at the end of his life, because you told me beforehand, because this wasn't, I don't think you said this in the documentary.
93 was what he had in Oregon. Because when he went back to Pune,
93 Rolls Royces, when he fled the country and they arrested him, 93 Rolls Royces.
All of them had custom paint jobs. You should see the custom paint
There's
jobs.
There's one for sale in Los Angeles for $1 million. You can buy
it. One of his Rolls
Royces.
One
of his Rolls is called the Black Kimono.
The Black Kimono.
I just plugged the Black Kimono. it's available. You can Google it on.
It's going to go up in sales. This doc sort of catches life. Like, and you know someone's going to buy that fucking Rolls Royce.
I think so. It's pretty crazy looking.
But yeah, he was basically the first guru to just like marry Western capitalism with Eastern mysticism. He was kind of the first guru to say, like, don't be ashamed of your wealth. You don't need to be embarrassed about your wealth. And so a lot of highly successful Westerners kind of flocked to his ashram in Pune because they were attracted to this message of to be enlightened, you don't need to reject everything. You don't need to reject sex. You don't need to reject wealth. You don't need to reject alcohol. You can live a path of enlightenment while still enjoying all those things. And
There's a few defenses, I'll call them, of like the Rolls Royces, but there's obviously like some legitimate criticisms about them too.
What are the defenses?
The defenses are a couple things there, and this is just what we heard while talking to members of Rajneeshpuram. One was that it was like a little more historical in that like Bhagwan was raised in India at the time of British imperialism, and Rolls-Royce was like a very significant car of the British imperialist. It was like the height of accomplishment, luxury of Western civilization. So I think specifically why it was a Rolls-Royce was, I think that there's a story of Bhagwan seeing a Rolls-Royce when he was 7-8 years old.
But why 93 Rolls-Royce?
Let's say that's not a defense. That's just why Rolls-Royce.
93 Rolls-Royce. I don't even think there's a rapper alive.
Two Chainz,
no 50 Cent, nobody in their fucking day, in their hate. Floyd Mayweather doesn't have 93 Rolls-Royce.
I think that Bhagwan was, like, I don't know if it can be talked about or diagnosed really, but there's like a collector's syndrome that I've come across with people with baseball cards or something like that, where it's like you have a compulsion of collecting. Because we didn't really get into it in the documentary, but it just wasn't Rolls Royces. He had these pens, like foreign pens. Like, he was obsessed with pens and calligraphy, where he would collect a ton of
Rolls. I really think it was more like, this is going to get press. You know,
it's
like,
true, it's too. It was attention.
He was aware of it.
He was the first one to be like, people aren't going to talk about my meditations that I like to do. Dynamic meditation isn't the sexiest topic to talk about.
Is that what he titled it? Dynamic meditation?
That was what he invented. That was like his contribution to like the world of meditation. Okay. But I think he thought, these Rolls Royces, it'll get me on talk shows, it'll get people talking about me, and through that, they'll come to learn about my spiritual teaching. So it was kind of what I took away from it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he lived a really unique life on the ranch, in the sense that he takes this vow of silence, kind of just takes a step back, so to speak, just kind of chills in his awesome house on the ranch. And one of his big activities that he did was, he drove about 2 to 3 hours every day. He'd drive off the ranch, he'd drive to this town called Madras, which is about an hour and a half off the ranch, and then back. And that was his life that he kind of lived. I mean, other than that, it was probably the one area in the documentary that we didn't have that much footage of, which was like Bhagwan's day-to-day, daily life. Cameramen, it was pretty much off limits to cameramen, and we didn't have a ton of footage of what his life was like. But for some reason, like, his joy and kick was definitely driving around in his Rolls Royces.
Okay.
So, which pissed a lot of people off in Eastern Oregon, because they, right, like, cause, like, I mean, like, these are like kind of salt of the earth people, and they're looking out their window, and for better or worse, it might be jealousy, it might be envy, it might just be
confusion.
Like,
because paint a picture. I'm assuming that most of the people that are going to be listening to this have watched it, but paint a picture of what
the story is.
The town looked like at the time. I mean, it's like, it's 1981.
Even when you're there, it's a town of 40 people. And when you're then
40
residents, and there's basically one dirt road that goes through town, and then there's kind of like one cross section that goes through town.
Like, it's small town, it's tiny town. You can't even call it a small town.
Yeah, I mean, they have a church in town that they all go to, and they have a school.
They had a cafe.
They had one cafe, which was kind of like the local center. But it's dirt roads, and so the image of this Indian man, who they knew nothing about, driving down the center of their dirt road in these insanely expensive Rolls Royces, just got everyone riled up.
It was the first time a Rolls Royce was ever driven to Antelope, right, and the last time a Rolls Royce will ever be driven to Antelope. Right. It's like Bhagwan, Rajneesh, and them people. But yeah, basically, just to give a little background, Antelope is this tiny town in Eastern Oregon. It's a population of 40, and today it's around the same. But
really?
19 miles away was the largest private piece of property in the Pacific Northwest. It was called the Big Muddy Ranch, and it was for sale. And basically, this group of Indian followers and American followers of this Indian mystic named Bhagwan Rajneesh, they come to Eastern Oregon. They buy this piece of property, the Big Muddy Ranch, in 1981, and they rapidly spend around $120 million just turning this kind of barren wasteland of a ranch into their kind of like spiritual oasis in the desert. And a war ends up erupting in Eastern Oregon.
All right. To back up with Bhagwan, he's an, you call him an Eastern mystic.
Guru. He's a guru. I mean,
How does someone get the classification guru?
That's a great question.
Does he classify it himself? Yeah. Can anyone be a guru? Yeah, can I say I'm a guru? Do you have to take a driver's test?
Self-proclaimed. I mean, he said most people capture enlightenment right before their death is the usual path to enlightenment. But Guan was rare in that he said he achieved enlightenment at the age of
21.
21, he had an enlightenment experience, which is in the spiritual world very rare. He took on the name Baguan, which I believe roughly translates like as godly or the godly figure. Something like that was the name, you know, he chose for himself. And so,
but yeah, India has a deep tradition of gurus. I mean, it's like, for lack of a better word, it's one of their best businesses. It's a big export that this country has had is kind of Eastern spirituality, Hinduism, Buddhism. They have strong traditions in
this
country.
But it's interesting you called it as a business.
It is. It's definitely, it's like, even today, there's like huge controversies in India over what they call them godmen. Like they're godmen. Like they're kind of self-proclaimed godmen. And I would say Bhagwan definitely fits into that tradition. He was interesting in that he actually had a PhD in philosophy, became a professor, and kind of built a following of like students, of other people in Pune that would come and listen to him lecture. And then the transition was he started traveling, giving traveling lectures, which is what other professors kind of do also in the United States. But then he makes this next transition in like the early 70s where he is the self-proclaimed enlightened guru, a walking like enlightened being. And he's going to set up shop as an ashram. And an ashram is like a permanent commune that's meant for seekers, people who are walking a path of enlightenment, trying to reach enlightenment, trying to raise their consciousness, breaking out of this karmic cycle of life, death, and rebirth. And that was the core of their theology.
And what about their theology and their beliefs with the sexuality? Because that's one of the things on Twitter.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Like, is it a fuck fest? is Bhagwan fucking everybody?
But it's not fully like explored.
Been kind of interesting because in the press, you know, they're labeled as a sex cult. So that immediately gets people like, what is this? You know, what's this all about? You know, when we did our research, like the big philosophy was he didn't believe in monogamy. He believed in open marriages. And so he believed if married couples come that they should experiment sexually, they should find new partners. They shouldn't be, you know, contained or constrained to just one partner. And so in the India days, this is pre them coming to America, there are more stories of
orgies,
therapy groups encounter groups with a lot of people being naked and a lot of sex happening. But the thing was, like, when they came to America, they were spending so much time just building this city that all of them said, like, we didn't even have time to, like, have sex. Like, it was so intense and so crazy that we were, like, labeled this sex cult. But really, it was, like, open marriage was kind of, like, what we all believed in. You know, it wasn't, like, these satanic, like,
I got you,
sex fests happening, you know.
And what about Bhagwan? Is he have the pick of the litter? Like, you know, the townspeople, I believe, talk about the look.
Right.
They all had this look. Yeah, and I was watching it trying to be as biased as I possibly can. And I have no judgment at the end.
Right.
Like, I really don't think anybody was necessarily 100% right or wrong.
That's a great takeaway.
At the end of the film,
that's
a
solid takeaway.
But when you do that montage of the look, I'm like, they all have that look. and to explain it to people that are listening, the look, like, it's like they seem very happy, almost like they're hopped up. Is there drugs involved? And I don't want to, because there's so many fucking questions. Was there drugs involved? Because if you said that look today, if you showed a picture of like somebody with that look, you'd be like, he's smoking some of that good shit.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. In my experience early on in the ranch, and like your average everyday sannyasin was like not really on drugs. They were
like, you don't need drugs. Right. Like, this is a new age community. You're coming here to feel fulfilled without alcohol, without drugs, was the message they were selling. So they weren't selling a message of like, come here, let's drop acid.
It's not like a pot. It's not like Woodstock.
It wasn't that, yeah.
But sure, in Pune, India, in the 70s, yes, there are stories of drug smuggling.
But it's not like a big,
it's not a part of their
I got
their,
you.
Their,
yeah, it's their not like a rave or anything like that. But I would say like their devotion to Bhagwan when he would drive by in his Rolls Royces was religious ecstasy. I mean, it's comparable to kind of like, I don't know, I've seen videos of Southern Baptists, you know, going
I think it's like when the Pope drives by. Yeah. You know, the Pope had his Pope mobile and he drives by and you see it and it's very strange.
I know. It's something that's hard because we struggled with it in the sense of like, it's hard to intellectualize in a way that you're going to convince someone who doesn't feel that way. And at some point, we almost just ended up like taking their word for it, like that they felt this way.
Obviously, a lot of people have been like, "Why didn't you go into the teachings? Why didn't you show this?" And it's like, it's not an intellectual thing. It's an inside thing that these people felt. And like Max said, like, we didn't feel like we could be there to judge. I mean, they all had this experience,
or like try to pick it apart.
And interesting enough, we weren't able to include it, but sort of. But even like the federal prosecutors, even people who don't believe in it were like, dude, being in a room with that guy, like, there was some energy.
Which is like Bhagwan.
Yeah, with Bhagwan.
They all said that.
Even the locals.
Who couldn't stand him.
Who couldn't stand him. They all said there's something with
this.
It's a question of like, if you believe that people have an inherent charisma. Like, there's some
like
people
where Brad Pitt walks in a room and everyone's like, holy crap.
That's true.
Dude, Brad Pitt's here.
When you're with Brad Pitt, you're like, that's fucking Brad Pitt.
Or Mick Jagger. I mean, certain people just have this energy.
Leonardo DiCaprio. Like when you're with Leonardo DiCaprio, like, I could see why you're Leonardo DiCaprio.
People said JFK walked into a room and like you could just feel a presence of some kind that was him. So I mean, not that I'm equating everyone with him, but there's a celebrity, there's a projection,
it's a star quality,
there's a charisma,
right? Yeah. And it is true because we could do it to movie stars or athletes or certain people. Okay, the ranch that they set up, it was built with $110 million. We're talking about $110 million in 2018 is a lot. Yeah. $110 million in 1981 is...
Yeah.
Sure. I don't know what the inflation or what the rate is.
Everyone's been asking, like, where did the money come from?
Answer this question, though, the estimation of the ranch came from at the end of the ranch when they filed bankruptcy and they did an evaluation of what the land was worth, the buildings, how much money had been spent. Right. And bankruptcy court said it was around $110 to $125 million. That's how much money had been spent. It wasn't what it ended up selling for because they couldn't get that on
it.
But that was the estimation through bankruptcy proceedings. So that's where that number comes from.
That's crazy, though.
The money, there was like pretty much two components to the money. One was he was the first guru to kind of put his lectures and his discourses on tape and books. So he had this worldwide publishing empire. I mean, they sold thousands of books around the world. And
so some of the money was just his earned money.
Subscription money where it's like you would buy, like not you, but like a Rajneesh follower, whether they were in the ashram or in Italy or Australia, like or Berkeley, they would buy the Rajneesh tapes 1 through 30. And he gave 2-hour-long discourses, AM and PM, every day for about like 11 years when he was in ashram.
It's a big collection.
It was like pre-Netflix almost.
I think he wrote over 200
like,
books.
He was a subscription model. And that was that was a source of income. The other big source of income.
Do you know how much that was?
I think the majority of the money.
The second component was donations. I mean, these were highly successful people that came from very successful backgrounds all over the world.
Because a lot of people that are in the doc.
And a lot of people emptied their bank accounts. I mean, it wasn't a requirement to be a part of this group. But if people had a lot of money, felt like I'm going to live the rest of my life in this community and I want to donate my life savings to it.
That was a perception that I don't know if we were able to totally capture in the doc series, which was people who felt who donated everything to come live at Rajneeshpuram, they thought they would die there. Like, they thought it was like, they thought that we would have, they believed in this utopia that was like, I might not have a need for shelter and food. Like, I'm going to be a part of a permanent commune type of living situation. So I am eager to donate to this, to this dream that we are all believing in. And so that was a big component. And then they would like do these, they basically had a global network of satellite communes that would also kind of raise money and contribute to Rajneeshpuram. And then also, like, they have the world festivals where it's like 10,000 sannyasins would come and drop a lot of money to come do their big summer festivals.
In our research, the money issue didn't really come up until the later years of the commune, where the commune wasn't as self-sustainable as they were hoping.
That's a good point.
And so Sheila was really putting pressure on members to donate and donate. And it definitely created some, you know, fractures within that community of people feeling like, hey, I joined this for meditation and spirituality, and every time I see Sheila, she's hitting me up for my checkbook. So, and then does the
and Sheila started,
the Oregonian investigator talks a little bit about that in episode 4.
And in Sheila's defense, she starts to talk about like when the Rolls Royces would get from 30 to 40 to 50 to 60 to 70 to 80, and now you're talking 90. It's like she was saying, like, yeah, there was expenses on the community that were draining us in some ways. But that, Chap's right, that's more like 84, 85. 81, 82, 83 is kind of a little bit of a different story.
Going to the technicalities of making the movie, which, by the way, one of the most annoying things about making any doc, especially something that spans so much time, is when people, and I'm sure you just mentioned that people ask you, why didn't you put this in there? No, even with 6 hours, you can't put everything in
there. It comes
from
a nice place, too. I never feel like they're interested, and I'm happy to talk about it.
But you feel like, you know, it's like, because also like the grounding pound of making a doc, and then also you need to be able to tell a story. So it might be a good thing to explain in an interview or a podcast.
Absolutely.
You know, I have
compassion for... And you need someone to explain it coherently on camera, or we don't have a narrator. It's not like we can just break in, press pause, and Mac and I can narrate. You know, you're reliant on what information.
We didn't have any B-roll for this, and no one would interview, but I'm the director.
Constrained by it. And it's like, in a certain sense, this story was so forgotten, and there was a lot of material out there, but in a lot of ways, like, we felt like we were almost starting from scratch on this huge religious movement that came to Eastern Oregon, went to war with the state. It was, ostensibly, it's like, you do see Sheila on Ted Koppel and Phil Donahue and all these things, but it's like, when you're first starting out, you don't know that that footage exists or that's out there. You just keep on researching and talking to people and finding it. And so it's like, we always talk about, like, we feel no ownership over the story of Rajneeshpuram. If people want to pick it up and continue, like, I would be the first person to read a book on it, to hear a podcast on it, to see another documentary, a documentary series on it. It just kind of felt like tons of things
that weren't included. I mean, like you said, you think 6 hours, but there's so many storylines, so many characters that, like, hopefully the story continues, because it is a fascinating story and there's many more stories to be told.
At what point did you guys know when you started, like, you were like, okay, we're going to make this movie? Number one, where did the financing come? Was it through Netflix? And number two, when did you decide 6 parts? When did you decide, like, there's no way this is going to be 2 hours, even at most?
So it's kind of like a multi-step process. Like, Mac and I are big believers in, like, betting on yourself. So we took, like, the little money that we got from selling our first documentary and kind of immediately put it into this. We bought cameras. We started digitizing the footage. We started interviewing characters, pre-interviews, not our final interviews. So, like, the first initial financing just came from Mac and I and my wife, Julie, who's our producer. And the three of us kind of dove in. And then after about
Which is a good thing for all young filmmakers, especially young documentary filmmakers or filmmakers in general. I agree.
Yeah. You gotta just wait. They keep waiting for someone to knock on their door, the opportunity.
The door's not getting knocked on.
It's not getting knocked on. You really got it. I mean, we had a hugely successful doc at Sundance and maybe a couple opportunities here or there, but really you got to create your own opportunities. And so we immediately knew if we want to have, like, a long career, like, we've got to bet on ourselves.
And you have to learn how to do it. It's like, learn to edit, learn to shoot, learn to do these things. You know, I think that in film,
you try not to rely on too many people.
Exactly. If you rely on other people to, like, no, I'm going to hire a DP, I'm going to hire an editor, I'm going to hire, it's like you should learn how to do those things so you can make it on yourself and take control of your project.
And then after about a year, through our sales agents, we hooked up with Mark and Jay Duplass, who were, like, huge coming on board. We knew if we were going to do this as a series, we really needed some, like, extra help, some extra name recognition,
some juice to go
into distributors.
And so, but at this point, you knew this has to be a series.
We knew it has to be a
this
series.
This can't be 90 minutes.
Exactly. Once we kind of started getting, basically there's three huge legal stories. There's the separation of church and state battle. There's this huge land use battle. And there's this huge immigration fraud battle. And so we knew, like, even just diving into these topics, like, it's got to be multi-form or else it's just going to cheapen the story. We can't really get into what all the conflicts are. So within a month of research, we just knew there's no way to do this.
Yeah, and just the different perceptions of the same story became very interesting to us at a certain point where it's, you have perception of Rajneeshis, which also can fall into two camps, current Rajneeshis and former Rajneeshis, very different perceptions. Then you have the perceptions of Antelopians and other neighboring ranchers and Wasco County residents. And then you have kind of the stories of Oregon state prosecutors and federal prosecutors.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And all those have very different perceptions of the same event. And eventually, I think with a feature doc, I don't know why I think this, but I do, which is that one of those sides would have prevailed more as, like, your audience walking away from the feature would have been like, oh, this side was right, that side was wrong. In a series, I think we were excited by the possibility of, because we didn't really know. I mean, it seemed like both sides could be right at sometimes and both sides could be wrong and both sides did awful things to each other. Mm-hmm. And so in a series, that bigger canvas kind of allows you to really capture a lot of different perceptions and give everyone kind of a fair shake to tell the story.
Which was really our pitch to Netflix. Like, we told them, like, this is not a traditional true crime narrative. This is not a whodunit. This isn't a series based on evidence, who's guilty, who's innocent. This is really an exploration of this religious group and what led them to this mass
It's a guru
poisoning.
Doc.
Yeah. It's a guru
it's
doc.
It's not a murder doc.
It's not a murder
well,
doc.
Well, the fact
you know?
Is that...
I think they're actually excited by that because, like, the Jinx had just come out and it wasn't... They hadn't quite released Making a Murder yet, but they knew that was coming out, and I think they were excited, like, hey, this is going to be something different that we'd like to be
a
part of.
The thing was, is when we first started, like, when you Google Rashtish Purim, the crimes are well known and documented, and people pled guilty to them. So it wasn't that, like, who done it, who's innocent, who's guilty, because that it just didn't seem like there was a lot to unravel there or reveal. But it seemed like the work that we were excited by is, okay, how does this peace-loving group who's practicing meditation and yoga end up... How do people, part of this group, end up poisoning 750 people? How do they end up busing in all these homeless people? How do they end up doing conspiracies to assassinate political officials? And it's that process of either how they justified that or how, you know, they can't justify it, that it was that process of almost radicalization that we were very interested in, whether that happened internally or whether that was because of external pressures put on the community. Those were, like, kind of some of the central questions we were interested in exploring in the series.
And you guys... I'm gonna just continue to kiss your ass because. By the way, can the film be up for an Oscar nomination, or you didn't do that?
I don't think they do it anymore. I think OJ Made in America was, like, the last time that was allowed. I think you have to, like, release it theatrically, and there's a lot of qualifications.
It's a little bit about the intent. The short answer is no, Wild Wild Country is not going to be eligible for any Oscars, but we do have, like, Emmys and things that's more TV-focused. I mean, for us, like, we intended it to be a documentary television series.
But sometimes
that was,
they'll put it in the...
I think, yeah.
Okay, all right. Sheila. I loved her. She fucking drove me crazy. And I'm like, is this a lunatic?
Yeah.
And then to watch her interviews and watch her journey in the old footage. And then, like, the last episode where you show where she's working in a hospice now. I mean, this is a person who talks a lot of shit, like myself. I respect the shit out of it. It's a woman.
Yeah.
It's a brown woman in the 80s who was going on these shows talking shit basically on... You know, it's like if you're not of that age, like Phil Donahue, it's like CNN. It'd be like if someone goes on Anderson Cooper and like is like basically saying, kiss my fucking ass.
Yeah, she was on Crossfire.
She didn't give a fuck.
Yeah. She was like pre-Jerry Springer, before Jerry
Springer.
She was
like a one-man Jerry Springer. Like, she was bringing the fucking noise. Like, she'd be break the internet.
Yeah,
there was like
she would.
Now there's plenty of people that do that.
Right.
So how did you get in touch with Sheila?
Sure.
And what was the first time you met her? And just give me your whole sort of Sheila takeaway.
Absolutely. So, yeah, like you just said, you know, we had watched hours of archive of her just eviscerating these talk show hosts and people in the audience. And, you know, we were immediately drawn to her. She was witty. She's charming. She's funny. And so we did some research on Google and came across this kind of hospice.
Google
center.
Is a motherfucker, huh?
It is, man. But yeah, we found these, like, little health clinics that she runs in Switzerland. And we didn't even know. It's like, is it the same Sheila? Is this the right person? But, you know, we sent off an email. And I think within a few days, we got a response and got her on the phone. And
was the email saying, we're making a movie?
It was a little bit just like, hey, we'd love to talk to you about this.
It was pretty early on. And I mean, but we had talked to Oregonian officials, federal officials before this. Just trying to put our toe in the water of the story. And I mean, how do they describe Sheila?
Yeah, I mean, this was an exact quote. They said she was pure evil, was how they described her to us. And so,
they mean that sincerely, too.
Sincerely,
because of the crimes that she committed. And
which
other
were
people,
what?
Basically,
to remind people.
Basically, what she ended up pleading guilty to was there was an attempted murder on the ranch of Bhagwan's doctor, a man named Dave Araj.
Good looking guy,
not a bad looking guy.
He looks like the most interesting man in the world. Like, he was, you know, he had the beard, he got the hair, tall.
Yeah, there was also a conspiracy, which was an assassination plot to kill the U.S. Attorney for the District of Oregon, Charles Turner. That was a guilty plea, was a part of that. And there was also putting salmonella in salad bars in 10 restaurants in the Dalles, Oregon, which is a town in Oregon, where 751 people got salmonella poisoning. It's considered the largest biochemical terrorist attack in U.S. history. It should be noted, Sheila did what's called an Alford plea, which is, I'm pleading guilty, but it's only because you have enough evidence to prosecute me. But it's kind of like, I'm guilty on some of these things, but I'm not guilty on some of them. And she's never admitted to everything, but in our interview, what we found was she was willing to give us justifications for why shit happened the way it did without ever fully going on and fully admitting everything, which totally lends itself to like credibility questions. Is she credible? Is she not? I think in Wild Wild Country, she comes off as someone that's reliable at times and unreliable at other times. But we were still interested in talking to her because she was such a decision maker as a part of the community. It seemed like stupid to make a documentary series on Rajneeshpuram without getting Sheila's perspective in it.
Yeah, but as soon as we got her on the phone, she was a little hesitant at first, but I think once we told her what we were kind of interested in, I think it became clear that she feels like she's never been given an opportunity or a platform to really say like her version of the events, what she was interpreting. And it's really interesting. I mean, when you talk to her, I think there is maybe a valid argument that they felt incredibly persecuted out there for their religious beliefs. They felt like they were dealing with a lot of bigotry, a lot of government overreach and trying to dismantle this community and this city. And it was really interesting to watch Sheila's progression as a young 17-year-old hippie girl who went to school in New Jersey. She went to college out here. She was part of the Flower Power movement. She's a fine artist. She does a lot of paintings.
Oh, okay.
You know, she's really smart, really well-read. And, you know, and then marries this young American Jewish man. It's a whirlwind romance that they have. And at 27 years old, she finds herself widowed. He passes away from Hodgkin's lymphoma and kind of after this passing kind of dives headfirst into running this religious empire of this guru. And so she's had a real fascinating story to tell. And, you know, we kind of, Mac and I talked, like, we weren't, this wasn't going to be like an interrogation with her. Like, we just really wanted to sit down, similar how we're doing. Like, hey, you, like, let's walk us through.
This is a fucking interrogation, guys. Don't worry. This is fucking softening you up. Fucking, this whole place is wired. Trust me. The gates are shut.
But yeah, and we visited her twice before we even interviewed her.
You went to Switzerland.
Went to Switzerland twice. She's still on Interpol's list. She never served times for she's on Interpol, which means she can't travel outside Switzerland because she never served time for her federal offenses. She only served prison time for her state crimes.
And how long was that?
She ended up doing 2.5.
It's a really legally complicated thing, but basically Oregon State filed charges against her and other Rajneesh leaders, and they pled guilty and struck plea deals, and they served prison time in Oregon. Sheila has this really interesting story, which we weren't quite able to get into the series, but she basically got out a month earlier than the federal government thought she was going to get out on not like a good behavior, but she painted the interior of the prison, and the prison warden credited her 30 days of prison. So she gets out of Oregon State Prison, takes a flight to Switzerland before the federal government is able to organize their federal charges against her and other people. And basically, I didn't get the details of it.
That's
interesting. But federal prosecutors told me that people were fired and that heads rolled because Manon Sheila got out 30 days early in prison, was able to take a flight to Switzerland, and they were never able to extradite her back to the United States
again.
That
is interesting.
Yeah, I wish I would have had 10 hours to tell Washington's Prime. I feel like I tell these stories, and I wish I would have had 4 more episodes.
Dude, to jump ahead, and I was going to ask this at the end, but I don't want to forget anything because you're just giving me so much information. You have to do it. You have to do your version of a follow-up. Yeah. Like at least like a year from now, if it's like just a 2 hours thing. Because I'm sure you guys saw the staircase.
Yeah, absolutely.
They did their follow-up.
There's so many questions. It's incredible just how many people start coming out with their own stories, though. I mean, we've been getting emails from so many people on all sides.
Have
of
you
this
thought
issue.
About it? Or are you like, we've fucking, you're just
a
like
part
getting
part of us that's like, this was 4 years. Like, I got go you. Make,
okay,
let's,
so there's
let's
no
go
plans.
Back to sports and let's do a fun sports.
Right, that seemed like nothing. Like a 2 hour.
So there's part of us that wants to do that, but there is a part of people really feeling like, hey, here's some information that might be of interest to people. And so we're just kind of in the process of like vetting that stuff now.
I got you.
Some of it's absolutely insane and you have no idea if this is true or not.
I got you.
Some of it's more credible. And so, there definitely is more things coming out that I think if you enjoyed the series, you'd be really fascinated to know.
Okay, so jumping back to Sheila, one of the things that frustrated me about her, and I was like, is this a fucking maniacal murderer? Or attempted murderer, because she didn't actually murder anybody. Sure. When you say she did her time and then leaves the country and goes to Switzerland, I mean, anybody would do that.
Yeah.
Well, not anybody. Not anybody would do that because you know, Jane, she came back, obviously, because she wanted to be with her son. You know, I mean, it's an understandable thing. You do 2.5 years. Like, one of the things that I respected about her and drove me crazy, she's unapologetic.
Right.
To this day, even sure. in the older version of Shillin, yeah. how old is she in the...
She's 68.
She's only... What a life.
Yeah, today she's 68. Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, obviously when she's young, Shillin, and she's, you know, at the ranch, she doesn't give a fuck. Like, she's ride or die. She's like... She's basically, you know what she's like? She's like Tupac to Rajesh Suge Knight. Like, right, she's like on that Tupac shit. Sure. Like, yo, he's fucking Death Row Records. Come to Death Row Records.
And she's... Well, that's what's fascinating. Like, she really believed in what she was doing. I mean, like...
100%.
You
know,
sometimes you see, like, Kellyanne Conway on the news, and you're like, does she really believe what she's saying about Trump? Or is she just like... But Sheila's, she really...
She's thug life.
She's thug life, dude. She's down for it. Like, a lot of people think she took the fall for this. She didn't rat out anyone when it came time for her prison sentence. You know, she gave nothing up on the guru.
Right, and so they had a breach.
Yeah, so, and they had a falling out even, and she still refused to give up any information. And
she's
so,
ride or fucking
she's
die.
Ride or die. So she's this really just fascinating character to talk to. But yeah, I mean, there is a lot of different interpretations. Like, is she a psychopath? Is she not? And it's been so interesting to hear different people's interpretations of, like, her journey and her character.
When you guys are making this film, how are you processing not judging her? You're watching this old footage, and then this person that you're seeing from 20 years ago, you meet in real life. And I don't care if it's 10 hours, 20 hours, when you're in front of somebody,
sure.
it's a different version.
Yeah.
You're seeing them jokes, you're seeing them burp,
sure,
you know, you're seeing them, you know, bumping, you're seeing an actual...
And you're also thankful. Like, you're thankful that they're sitting down and talking to you. Like, there were a lot of people that dodged a lot of our phone calls and emails and had wanted no part of the series. And Sheila was, like, kind of... Yeah, she was a little badass about it. She was just like, she allowed two Americans. We had made an Oregon baseball documentary, so we kind of had this Oregon connection. She went to war with the state of Oregon, and she kind of allowed us just to come in and ask us whatever we wanted. So on surface level, you're like thankful for that, you know, and that's helpful. I mean, the other thing is like, I totally empathize and I understand people who say, like, Sheila and the Roshnishi's arrival and presence in Oregon had a serious and a traumatic impact on my life in a very, very negative way. If they live next to Roshnishpuram or if they were poisoned in the Dalles, I understand that, and I do. So I am the first to admit, hey, it's real easy for me, who grew up in the 90s in Los Angeles and my life wasn't impacted at all by Mon on Sheila, to go meet Sheila and trying to have an open conversation with her. I mean, again, I don't think that Chap and I actually truly felt like a real need to condemn attempted murders and poisonings. Like, that's obvious. Like, mm-hmm. that shit is bad and no one should do that. But Wild Country was intended for mature adults that could watch this series, know that that shit is bad, but then still be willing to kind of listen to someone talk about why they were pushed to do the things they were willing to do. That's hopefully part of the entertainment of Wild Country.
Right. It's good, interesting you said entertainment and adults, because now I'm thinking about, like one of the Twitter questions, and I can imagine there might be other people, like, you're interviewing a person that could have killed this person, or you're, you know, like, this is like, if it wasn't a woman,
she doesn't deserve a platform or a microphone anymore.
But I think you had to deal with that
a little bit. But I truly feel like audiences are intelligent enough to know if they feel like a character is spinning them, or if they feel like that they have an agenda. And like, I think that there's this need for audiences, like, they just want to be told what's right and what's wrong, and they want to be make sure they're on the good side. But I feel like if I'm watching an audience, like when I watch Jinx, like, I could tell there's something off with Robert Durst, and I can't trust everything he's saying. I didn't need Jarecki to tell me that, you know, like,
if you give it enough time on camera,
you're gonna feel where their holes in their arguments are, where they're trying to justify certain things. And that's hopefully part of the entertaining process of diving into this, like, long 6-hour stories. You're not just being spoon fed like, hey, this is bad, this is wrong, you know, like, you're having to kind of figure it out for yourself. And that's what we wanted to do, you know.
How long did you actually physically interview her? How long were the sessions? And where did you interview her?
Our interview schedule, we spent 5 days with her.
Did you know it was going to be 5 days?
Yes, that was what we kind of scheduled with her, and it was 4 hours a day. So we ended up with like 20 hours of total interview time. And we started from her being 5 years old in India to what she's doing now. So it was an entire, like,
biography
of her whole life. And then we interviewed her kind of, she owns this two houses in Switzerland where she takes care of patients with dementia and those are Alzheimer's.
She doesn't work there. That's her.
That's her business.
She has a staff, but yeah, that's like her business.
Which was pretty incredible. Yeah. I mean, we didn't really get into it, but after prison, she moves to Switzerland. She learns to speak German from scratch in her later years. She started off as a dog walker. Then she became a cleaner. She cleaned houses as a maid for a while. And then through cleaning houses, she was taking care of this older couple. And that was kind of like her first client and started taking care of older people. And through them, kind of built this network of people with mental illnesses that she can take care of in their later years.
One of the questions that, because we wanted to show that not just to have this like, oh, Sheila's a great person type of thing at the end. But one of the questions that I ask myself is, does everybody deserve a second chance? And that's and there's right and wrong answers to that. It's like, regardless of your opinion on second chances,
does
like
everyone deserve a redemption story or not? You know, or who's worthy of a redemption story, I think is a really fascinating topic.
Especially in this day and age.
Exactly.
Because is Louis C.K., like when is it?
For sure. Like, how long is he in the doghouse for type of thing?
Right.
You know? And it was like, and I think with the case I'm on Sheila, if you feel like she doesn't, then that could be a legitimate takeaway. If you think like, you know what, maybe we are a society that's like, yeah, you do your prison time, you're no longer really, you know, you pay your debt to society. And if you want to rebuild your life, you can go do that.
And I will say this. I mean, we spent a lot of time there without cameras rolling.
With Sheila.
Without even us knowing that we're around, Sheila works hard and those patients like love her. And so there's a lot of people that were watching this at the end going, oh my God, this is a horror show. This is terrifying. But our genuine takeaway is that she cares very deeply about her clients and patients and does a very difficult job of taking care of these people was kind of our legitimate, genuine takeaway, even when cameras weren't rolling.
This is a technical question. When you did your 5 days, 4 hours a day interviews with Sheila, how many cameras were you using, and did you do the interviews chronological order? You said you started off when she was 7.
Sure.
And like when you guys work together, like I'm interviewing the two of you, and I know from when I'm doing a doc, you know, who's asking the questions? Sure. Which one of you guys?
Yeah, so we had a DP. We had two cameras running. So our DP, Adam Stone, who shoots all of Jeff Nichols' films, like Midnight Special and Take Shelter, and is an incredible DP.
He was overqualified for our documentary series, but we were lucky to get him.
He was on one camera. I was operating the other camera, and then Matt kind of sits in the interview chair and asks the questions. It's kind of usually how we do it. And if I hear something that I think needs repeating, I also do a lot of editing, so sometimes I have an ear for like, oh, they're going to need to repeat that, or that's not going to cut together, so let's ask that, and I'll chime in every once in a while.
Yeah, it's kind of how we started, actually, because I was a history major. I went to UCLA. I was, like, obsessed with nonfiction stories, but I would kind of see my, like, these professors that I loved write these 500-page books that no one was reading, so I was immediately interested in documentary film. Our whole family's from the film industry. I never really thought we'd get into it, but I saw a documentary as kind of this kind of type of nonfiction filmmaking that I was really interested in. Chap was always kind of tried and true filmmaker, like went to film school, learned to edit, learned how to shoot, and so we
he's the brains of the operation.
He's like, he's technically very savvy, and like I leaned on that a lot.
I got
So we kind of had this division of labor where it's like I would do a little bit more of the research and a little bit more of the putting, like getting, like learning the story and doing the interviews, and then like Chaps got. I mean, it's so helpful to have him there because like, as I'm doing the interviews, he's the first person that I look to at the end and be like, do we get everything? Do we have everything that we need? And then like whatever he tells me to like get again, that always ends up making it into the show. It's like critical stuff that's like, oh yeah, we need that.
Or when you guys are doing it, did you break down the interviews with specifically Sheila? Because that probably was the most extensive in chronological order?
Yeah, we kind of did an interesting way. The first thing that we did before we even started our interviews was we basically wrote 6 scripts for each episode. So basically it's an archival story. We know the beginning of the story. We know how it ends. And so we knew that we were doing these 6 1-hour episodes. So we really like wrote a treatment for each episode. Here's the opening scene. Here's your page 8 moment. Here's the end of the first act. Here's your cliffhanger at end of episode 1. Here's your conclusion. So we really like structured
based it. On the archival footage?
Based on just the research. We read like over 20 books on this. We read a lot of the Gurus books.
We were doing pre-interviews with characters.
Pre-interviews with a lot. lot of characters.
Pre-interviews off camera.
Like off camera. Yeah, just research. Just like, hey, I want to, we're going to go grab lunch.
You know,
we're
one of these.
Yeah, you know.
Take our task cam recorder and go around and just talk to people.
That's interesting.
That because, and it really is like people, I love documentaries that people are making where it's current, modern day, and it's unfolding. And like, I would say one of the great benefits of being able to, being an archival documentary filmmaker is you get to kind of structure it. With Battered Bastards, we were able to structure it into three acts. Yeah. This was much different. We were able to do it in 6 1-hour episodes.
But it is a little, I think some people are of the belief, like, I just want to talk to you for the first time on camera so we can get something fresh and new. And that's definitely like how some people attack these interviews. But we feel like if we can get a little more information beforehand, it helps us inform our narrative, like how the narrative structure of the show will play out.
And because you know that it's so much and there's so much.
When we do our interviews, we know like, hey, these are big, or this is a huge archival video section. Like, we need Sheila to talk about the World Festival because that's a huge moment in episode 3. And so we kind of do a mix of just chronological and just making sure we're hitting our bullet points.
You totally stay. I mean, there's stuff like John Silvertooth in overalls, like when he started off a story with, well, I've never told this in public, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. It's like, you know, like, so it's like you have to be open to, you can't be controlling. It's like you're essentially.
Yeah, we're pretty free willing too. We're not like totally strict to our questions. If someone's going off on an interesting tangent, you know, we might dive into that as well.
Yeah, you play with that. And it's like, I think that we called our scripts like the Bible that we had made. We're like, well, like, and the Bible that we had was a little bit plot for plot. And it ended up being pretty accurate to what's in the series. I think the area that we couldn't really plan for was just the personal character arcs and development of our talking heads, because they really were our cast. And so that was something that we definitely stayed open to. And then, I mean, the story was just so complex that it was one of those things where we almost ended up with as many questions at the end as we started with, which was just kind of the nature of this wild ass story where, you know, it's a lot of different perceptions of the same event that happened, sort of thing.
When you guys were filming, I mean, I'm sure you had a bunch of them, but do you remember, like, you know, when I've had the pleasure of making docs, there's been a handful, like to this day, I could recall them, oh shit moments, where the way they're telling a story and you're just like, this is going to be in the fucking movie. And cool. You're just like, you know,
you can feel it. You can feel it in the room sometimes. It's really amazing. Like, you can just, you feel that sense of energy. And I think like one of the first ones that happened was just absolutely insane was when we were interviewing the assistant attorney general of Oregon, Bill Gary, and he was explaining to us how their real attempt to poison the water supply
with the beavers.
With the beavers. Yeah, and
the beaver in the blender.
Yes. So basically what they ultimately ended up doing was poisoning salad bars, but their first attempt, which what they really wanted to do, was they wanted to poison the entire water supply of this city with some sort of bacteria or salmonella, so that enough people would get sick on election day that they wouldn't be able to vote. It was a way to control the election. And so they trapped beavers.
Which are like have a really bad bacteria in them, apparently.
And known for
They trapped beavers, who trapped beavers?
Okay, well, this is a, so none of this is 100% known as fact, but according to the attorney, assistant attorney general, he told us that Roshnishis or sannyasins, people of this religious movement, trapped beavers on their commune. And then they took the beavers and then they were going to put the beavers, the live beavers, into the water supply. And through that, the bacteria and salmonella will infiltrate the water supply.
The problem that they ran into
when they got to the water tank in the middle of the town was that the opening, the gap between the lid,
was covered with wired mesh.
So they couldn't get the live beavers in there. So he's just telling us this very, very nonchalantly, very matter of
fact. And this wasn't in the pre-interview.
This was not in the pre-interview. And he said, you know, they couldn't get the beaver. They couldn't put the beavers in. And so what they did is they went back and they put the beavers in blenders, and then they blended the beavers to a pulp and then took the blended beaver pulp back to the water supply and poured the blended beavers into the water supply. And that was truly one of the most insane things I'd ever heard in my life. And I was on the camera and I remember just doing like a slow turn to Mac and not even saying anything. And we both just made eye contact without breaking face. And like, it's something only brothers can do, but we were just looking at each other like, what the fuck did that guy, did he just say? Yeah. You know, like, we were just so flabbergasted.
Yeah, and so what he said, which was really interesting, because as soon as he knew what he was doing and he landed it perfectly. And he was like, again, he's like, I have no idea if that's true or not, but he said it was told to me by someone who was there. And that was as deep as he was willing to go.
And that was as deep as he was willing to go. And there's no other information.
It was in like an affidavit, but he said it wasn't just what was put in the affidavit. He was talking about his own personal interviews with people who had pled guilty to stuff. And he said that this was a story that was told to him. He wouldn't name who, but he said it was told to him by someone who claimed they were there. No. So again, it's like, I wish we could have gotten like hardcore analysis and fact from there, but that was as deep as we could get on.
Did you either, while you were making it, after, since the movie's come out, ask Sheila, Sonny, or Jane about the fucking Beavers?
They don't know.
Because Bill Gary was interviewed.
And which guy is Bill Gary?
Bill Gary's the assistant U.S. Okay. Attorney General who told us the story. It was actually after we had interviewed all the Sonny Austins.
It was at the end, so there was not something that we knew.
If you saw Sheila
about.
Again, like, let's say, you know, you saw, would you be curious to ask
her? I would definitely ask, but they would 100% say.
Well, she's like, not saying, she's ride or fucking die. Yeah, for sure. But wouldn't you want to, like, follow up?
This is something that I think could be legitimate, is that I think that they felt that the people who were cooperating with government officials were kind of throwing the kitchen sink at the
That's
whole
a creative
community
kitchen sink. To try it. That ain't just a kitchen sink. That's a way out there shit to come up with.
The attempt was to try and get, you know, their prison time as down as little as possible. So it was kind of like, I mean, literally, the reason we put this section in, it's called Rumor Hotline. And the Oregon state government officials funded a rumor hotline because they were having such a hard time figuring out what was truth and what was fact. And we had that same problem too. I mean, this was a story of essentially 2,500 people who lived on this commune. It was impossible for us or anyone to know exactly what happened on the ranch at all times, when you get vastly different contradicting effects. And so I'm sure, I feel like I can go out of a limb and say that this would be a story that would be 100% denied by a lot of people. But again, it's like, this guy's telling you it, and he said, well, this was told by someone who was there. I don't know someone that would tell that story if they were there.
That's the fine line being a documentary filmmaker, you know? Like, it's not proven, it's not known. They obviously, of course, would deny it on the other side, but you have an AUSA.
He said it in
saying he heard it, and so
you gotta put it out there.
Yeah, sure. And it kind of is. It to me, it was symbolic of how much stuff can be embellished or how much stuff can be not. It was a little bit of the truth and fiction that was inherent in Wild Wild Country. I think.
Okay. Let me see. Okay, the homeless people. I have to say, as far as documentaries or just regular narrative films, was one of the wildest twists I'll never forget seeing, because I think my wife might have been up to that part when she first started watching it, and I was like screwing around doing something, and I came in, and then she goes, yo, you gotta see, and I'm like, and then I'm watching the tapes of the homeless people, and she's like, now they're drinking beer, and they're fucking poisoning the beer, or they're medicating the beer, and I was like, what the fuck, and that's when I started watching it. The recruiting of the homeless people is so far out. This is when I'm like, these motherfuckers are not, this is not yoga meditation. Like, this is an agenda here, and we're going to go to, you know, she says it, you know, play with the cracks, play with the, you know, of the law.
The loopholes.
Sheila says it, I think, in archival footage, right?
She said, if you're not finding the little loopholes, the gaps in the law, then it's your loss.
That's what I'm like, that's not a very spiritual practice, but... You know,
Sheila never claimed to be spiritual, which was really interesting too, which is what we talked about in episode one, which we didn't really know. And we were interviewing her, and she's like, dude, I didn't give a crap about the meditation. Meditation was a product. Meditation is what I sold to Westerners to come to build Bhagwan's empire. So she was all about the business. She liked running the infrastructure. Sheila was not there for spirituality or for enlightenment. I mean, she claims that she fell in love with this man, this guru, and she wanted to be the right-hand woman, the right-hand man, and make it all happen. And so that's when I kind of found her really interesting, is like, well, there's so many layers to the story. You know, Sheila has a completely different reason for being a part of this movement as from everyone else.
Okay. That's one of the best things you just said to me. I didn't know that specific thing. I mean, it was obvious by her actions that she was about her business, but to say, I didn't realize, and maybe I missed it, in the actual film, that she was like, I'm essentially a businesswoman.
She was the only sannyasin who the guru said didn't need to meditate, because Sheila hated meditation. So she got personal.
Sheila would fall asleep during the meditations, and it would piss a lot of her fellow Rajneeshis off.
This
and
is the gold right here.
Apparently, Bhagwan gave her a pass on falling asleep and during some of the meditations. I mean, yeah, Sheila wasn't very interested in kind of the I guess what they would say, walking the path of enlightenment.
Now, you said she fell in love with him. In The Breach, in one of his interviews where he came out of his silence, Bhagwan said, and this is, again, this is, I was like, if I'm a follower, like, this is not spirituality. Yeah. When he says, why would I fuck? Did he
for
say
sure.
fuck?
Yeah.
Did he say fuck
he
or
said,
sleep with?
Sleep with.
Why would I sleep with? She's a bitch.
Right.
And why would I sleep? Exactly. If I'm a spiritual person, right. If I'm in yoga class and right. my fucking, you know, my power yeah. yoga class in the valley on a Sunday and they start talking like this, right. I walk out, even right. me, and I'm a savage. Yeah. I'm like, this yeah. isn't a fucking, I'm trying to do my downward yeah, yeah. dog. I'm trying to get me.
I think what's so fascinating.
And they're like clapping. Yeah. I'm like, this is, you were.
Well, when we talk to sannyasins, ex-followers and even current sannyasins, you have to remember that he had taken a vow of silence. This guru had been silent for 4.5 years. He was supposedly in his silence, they felt was coming up with the master plan for them, for their religious movement, for what would lead them to enlightenment. That's why they were all out there in the desert. And so I think for this moment, when these followers hear for the first time, our master, our guru is going to break his silence. He's going to come out and they felt like he's going to come out and tell us what the next movement is in this grand experiment. They were looking to him for guidance. And he basically comes out and just throws Sheila completely under the bus. And
with very unguru, unspiritual-like language.
Absolutely. So, yeah. And I think you see very much that this is like a man who feels like he's been burned. He, like, you know, he's just a human being just like the rest of us. And I think that was, for a lot of sannyasins, a turning point for those that started questioning, what's really going on here? What am I a part of? Is this worth it? Like, we're supposed to be... When you talk to sannyasins, their goal was to transform the consciousness of the planet. And they say that very seriously.
Right.
That was their ambition. They felt like if we build enough of these communes around the world, mm-hmm. we will transform the consciousness. And so back to the Bhagwan breaking his silence and calling Sheila a bitch and claiming that she was jealous because he never slept with her. And I think was a very confusing time for everyone in that movement.
You know, we could talk about this story, you know, in all this sort of like, you know, like it's like Nat's Landing or like a soap opera.
Yeah.
But I mean, bare bone question. Did they have a sexual relationship? Did they have a personal relationship?
It was denied. Both of them said that they never slept with each
she
other.
She said
so
it also.
Sheila said that, okay. And Bhagwan
well,
also said that.
It.
So yeah, and I kind of believe it too. I take them both at their word.
We didn't get into it, but Bhagwan had a longtime caretaker slash girlfriend named Vivek that lived in his house with him, that was with him even in the India days. And so they were together for a couple decades.
Okay.
And so it was... told to us that was like his longtime partner.
If she said it, then I have
yeah,
to believe
that
it.
Was, right, exactly. Yeah, I really never heard any differently from anyone, which was like, oh no, they both are kind of in on this little
they just
secret.
Had this intense thing. It had to be some sort of intense
yeah, it,
relationship.
It's like gurus in India have kind of personal secretaries that are like these fall on the sword type of commitment devotions. I mean, it's a little bit of a tradition of mm-hmm. this in India, and we weren't quite able to get into the documentary, but Sheila's father, who was a part of like this kind of independence movement, he was part of Gandhi's independence movement, was a little bit older than Bhagwan, but really respected Bhagwan kind of as this up-and-coming philosopher guru who's provocative and pissing a lot of people off.
I mean, Sheila's father was really prominent member of Gandhi's inner circle and also spent time in prison for his involvement with Gandhi.
Did I miss
Gandhi.
This in the
no,
film? Okay, because I'm like, fuck,
it's
why
things
am I doing
we weren't
this?
Able to include, but Sheila grew up seeing her father as a freedom fighter who fought alongside Gandhi for the independence movement, served time in prison.
That makes
and that
a
was
lot
a
of
huge
sense.
Huge pivotal moment in her life, and I think she felt that she was doing the same thing with Bhagwan. And
I hate to make the Tupac yeah. comparison again, but Tupac's mother yeah. spent time in prison, yeah. You know, after doing stuff with the Black Panther. So yeah. I think that you
it's
know,
influential.
Like, there's no other rapper that's like yeah. Tupac, but Sheila sure. is like the Tupac. Yeah. All right, going back to the homeless people, did you try to track down any of them yeah. for interviews, or was that impossible?
We found two homeless people. It was really impossible. One, because they all took Indian names, sannyasin names, once they came on the ranch. So it's very hard to track down what even their American English names were.
And it wasn't just something that people were advertising about themselves in their past. Not only that they were like home, it was just a little bit. Most
one,
of our
we were able
were
just
secretive through, about
and,
it.
Like, just through tons of Google search, I was able to track down one homeless person. We ended up finding two. Neither of them wanted to go on camera and talk, but I did find their experiences really fascinating, and I'm happy to share that. One was, down and out, homeless, alcoholic, you know, just totally out on his luck, took this bus from Northern California up to join this community. And talked about it in incredibly glowing terms. It said it turned his life around. He got off alcohol. He wasn't drinking anymore. He actually went after this whole experience, went back to grad school, got his master's in theology, and became a pastor. And so,
met the guy?
We talked on the phone.
Okay, but he sounded like a sane person.
Sane person. Yeah. Went back, got his master's degree. He works in a religious community now. He's a pastor, and very much credits Osho's teaching, Bhagwan's teaching, for helping get him back on his feet. But because of what he's doing now, just wasn't really interested in talking to camera. The other one was actually a really bizarre moment that Mac and I were filming in Antelope. And we were filming the flagpole that they have in the middle of the town, right next to the post office. And this car drives up, and this man gets out of the post office and goes inside. And his son was sitting in the driver's seat. And the son said, "Hey, what are y'all doing out here? You know, like, what are you?" And we told him, "Oh, we're filming this story on Roshnish Purim." And he said, "No way, my dad was a member of that group." And I was just thinking, like, he was a follower of Sannyasin. But this is in the middle of Antelope.
Yeah, he said my dad was a part of that. I thought that he meant, like, oh, maybe his dad was on the Antelope City Council. Maybe he was on the school board. Like, I just thought, like, oh, definitely so
start
not.
I immediately start talking to this kid. And he's like, "No, my dad was a homeless man.
In Northern California also.
And took a bus up there and joined it." And I was like, "Wait, you guys are living in Antelope now?" And he's like, "Yeah, my dad never talks about it because we moved here like 10 years ago. My dad remembered the area, moved back here."
Wow.
And he was also someone that, despite knowing now in modern day that they were tranquilized with Haldol and poisoned, also spoke about it as like an incredible time where, like, yeah, we did work on the ranch, but we got free food, we got free clothes, they provided us health services, and he felt like it was a positive takeaway too, even despite knowing that they were used basically for voting purposes.
Yeah, I think a lot of these guys, because those were the two modern day ones that we spoke to, but we did have like hours of interviews with people in the time, and even the news stations would follow up with homeless people who had left the ranch afterwards. We had kind of these like hours of archive interviews, and it seemed to be that even the ones that weren't thrilled with their experience at Roshnish Purim were equally as resentful towards America in general as a country that they felt had completely abandoned them, in terms of, like, I was a Vietnam War veteran, I fought for this country, and I got the only helping hand that I ever got in my life was these people dressed in red who allowed me to come and be a part of their community for a couple weeks. And it was just a fascinating perspective to listen to these
people. I'm sure there's homeless people that feel differently, but those were the only two that we were talked to.
And we were able to
really wanted to get them on camera, but there was just no way they were going to get on camera and talk about it.
Again, with going to the way the homeless people were, in my opinion, they were inevitably, they were used, and then when it was found that they couldn't use them, they kicked them
off.
Discarded,
yeah.
You know, because the story of Sheila talking about the one guy attacking her, that's right. One of the homeless people.
So what happened? I mean, this was basically right when Reagan defunded all the mental institutions in America. So there was this influx of mental illness, leaving these mental institutions, living on the streets with severe mental illnesses. And so, you know, when the Roshnishis were rounding up these homeless people, there was no sort of checking these people out for who might be good for the community. They were taking anyone and everyone that was over the age of 18, an American citizen, and could vote. And so, you know, within weeks, thefts went up on the ranch, crimes went up, assaults, sexual assaults on the ranch. I mean, it was pretty soon that within weeks of busing in 5,000 homeless people, the entire community kind of began falling apart
because we talked to a lot of Sannyasins they're called Roshnishis, but they call themselves Sannyasins. We kind of use them interchangeably. But like what they were telling us was they would see buses of homeless people come into the community, and it was so far away from their kind of peaceful meditation, yoga, ambitions, and ideals that I believe that your average everyday Rajneeshi saw this and was like, this is the beginning of the end. Like, at least that's what they told us. Mm. They were like, we look back at this and we could not believe that this was what our leaders in our community, this was the plan that they had. So I think even from the get-go, there were a lot of just everyday run-of-the-mill Rajneeshis on the commune that were not thrilled about their utopia being turned into kind of a homeless shelter, for back of a letter.
And also, I mean, just to be fair and honest, a lot of the homeless people did stay until the very end. So the ones that were kicked out were ones that, you know, were creating some sort of commotion inside the community. I mean, even at the end, you see two or three homeless people that we show in episode 6 talking about how they don't want to leave.
Right.
And so just to be fair, it wasn't like they were, I mean, not that there's a way to be fair. I mean, what they did was awful, bringing them in and discarding them. But there were numbers of homeless that did stay until the very end.
Yeah, it was really complex. Like, almost every part of the story, because it was just, the numbers were large. You're talking, it was a permanent population around 2,500 that lived on the ranch. And then worldwide, you're talking 30, 40,000 sannyasins. And then even homeless people, you're talking 5,000. So
5,000
like,
of them came 5, in.
5,000 of them
came
in. So they
outnumbered the amount of people that were already there.
By 2 to 1. Yeah, I mean, wow. The plan was, there was about 12,000 Wasco County voters, eligible voters, for this 1984 November county elections. And they knew that they couldn't quite get those numbers. They couldn't quite get to 12,000. An interesting little factoid is that the voter participation rate in Wasco County for that 1984 election was 93%. It was the highest of any county in the nation.
It's interesting because, you know, obviously what happened in Alabama, you know, when people are clear and have a clear-cut agenda and are clear on who's running and why they're running, they vote.
They turn out. Yeah.
You know, absolutely. You know, whether that or, you know, like even in Alabama, it's like, you're like, it's between these two people. These are their agendas. Yeah. And motherfuckers come out.
The average voting rate for the nation that year was like below 50%. It was like 48 or 49%. So for a county to be in 93% was just
kind of one of
the
most fascinating things that I found in that whole thing was this kind of statewide rejection of all new voter registrations.
But couldn't they, it's like, what did you think of that? Because in my opinion, like, well, that's their rights. I'm like, this is a con here. Yeah. This is not their rights.
But they're following the letter of the law. It was 20 day voter. Like Sheila, I think at a certain point was like, fuck this, dude, I am gonna do like the elite. That was like,
just to be honest, to me, that's almost like one of the most terrifying things, because you expect the Rajneeshis to bend the law, you expect Eastern Oregons to bend the law to their advantage. But if the law is 21 days in the state of Oregon and you can vote, and you have people that fought in the Vietnam War, fought for this country, living in this commune, and they're being told that they can't vote, I mean, that was like, if you don't like the law, change the voter residency requirement laws. You can't just switch it whenever you feel like it. No, that was like,
because like, obviously, what some of the Rajneeshis did that were in kind of Sheila and Sheila's cohort. The illegal shit they did is like, okay, that's obvious, that's illegal. It's the shit that they did that was technically legal that is sometimes the more terrifying stuff, where it's like, they incorporated as a town, which meant they're allowed to have a police department that they can send people to the Oregon State Police Academy, get credited as police officers, and then they're legally allowed to kind of buy these almost semi-automatic like AK-47 assault rifles and arm their legal police force in their community.
Are you still allowed to do that to this day?
If you're an incorporated town, you are. You're legally allowed to have a police force, a fire department. You can tax your base. You're allowed access into Oregon statewide taxing pool money that the whole state taxes all their citizens for. As a city, you're allowed to tap into that pool and use some of that money to fund some of your public services. I don't know what other states are. I've only researched this in Oregon, but it's and that was kind of at the heart of the story, was the political power that you get if you can get 150 people to say they want a city. That was a game changer in the story.
Is that just in Oregon?
That Oregon was 150 people. Yeah, it's basically a rule. There are some states are called home rule states, which if you're a home rule state, and I think like more than half of the United States states are considered home rule states. It's like a small amount of people. It's like 150 people, 200 people, 300 people can sign a petition, and then you're allowed to petition your county government. And then your county government usually has a voting commission, like three people that will rule on whether to grant you an election. And then if you're allowed to have that election, then you're allowed to decide whether you want a town or not. That's usually the process. But the Rajneeshis was such an unusual case because once they got granted the election to have on their ranch, it was like 154 voters to nothing voted that they wanted have a city, and right, then there was nothing easy. They could do. That's what's terrifying about the story is all the legal shit that they did.
I got
that
you.
Was still. I mean, they became an 800-pound gorilla in the state of Oregon.
Well, I think it shows how easy, like, the fabric of our institutions can be challenged. I mean, we like to think we live in America and voting rights and police forces and all these things are like these sacred institutions. But if you want to like fuck with the system and you want to find the loopholes, it's not that hard to do. And I think that this series is a little bit of a warning sign of like what can really happen in our country if you get a group of devoted people that want to kind of bend the system towards their way. You know?
I agree. All right, because I've kept you guys. I want to just rattle off a couple of questions. The red clothing. I'm sure you've been asked this.
Not what, that much, actually.
Not about the red clothing?
Not too many people. We can get into it.
There was a couple reasons.
Why red?
Red was supposed to be the colors of like the rising sun, like in the morning. It was supposed to be a new start, a new day, a new beginning, like a new sunrise in the morning.
There's another kind of explanation, too, that I think is really interesting, which this could be getting too deep in the weeds, but I'll try and get through it quickly, which is the Rajneeshis call themselves neo-sannyasins, and there's a sannyasi. Or like it's called sannyasi tradition of rejection. It's asceticism, and it's dudes wearing orange robes that are incredibly impoverished, and that's their enlightenment.
In India, it's a long tradition.
There's a long tradition in India
of sannyasi.
And what was interesting was Bhagwan, as a provocative, very controversial guru, kind of appropriated the orange clothing, and it was insanely controversial in India. It would be like someone gave me this analogy. It would be like if you saw a couple of young 20-year-olds wearing like a priest collar and priest clothing running around your city, kind of making out, doing sexual shit to one another. And you'd be like, that's controversial. That's provocative.
That's
you're not supposed to put on a priest collar
and then act
very unpriestly. Like,
I got
and
you.
And that's kind of what they did in India, which was as Westerners, we don't see that. We just
but
see
that's
a bunch
how
of,
he was viewed.
But that's how it was taken in India. But then the other thing was these kind of sunrise colors, new birth, new age thing.
And then also, I mean, a lot of anti-cult people will tell you like that's a way to like get rid of someone's individuality and their individual identity, and like you become part of the group instead of an individual. Mm. So that's, you know, what a lot of anti-cult people have said. And then Bhagwan also said like it's meant to be provocative spiritually for you, where you have to face your friends, you have to face your teachers, you have to face your family and say, look, this is who I am now. Like, and you have to come, you really have to like.
That was in his writing.
That was called a device. And devices are kind of a part of this. Devices are supposed to be external struggles that you have internal spiritual growth through. And so there was this big mystic guy named like George Gurdjieff, and like a Gurdjieffian device would be this, like Gurdjieff would make you dig a 5-foot hole and it'd take you all day and you'd get your hands bloodied and blistered, and then he'd say, all right, fill it back up.
Fuck.
And then you'd be like, fuck, like that is awful. And like, and it was supposed to be this external struggle. So I'm not saying that I believe this, but when I would talk to a lot of sannyasins, they would say the whole experiment of Rajneeshpuram was a big device. We were supposed to build this $125 million utopian city, and it was supposed to collapse in 5 years. And we were supposed to have internal spiritual growth through that struggle. And it was a device
I'm really fascinated by it, because I'm curious, like, I remember there was a time where I was growing up where I was like, I want to be a filmmaker, but I'm uncomfortable calling myself a filmmaker. Mm. Like when people ask you, like, what do you are? And you're like, I haven't done anything. And like,
as an actor, I'm sure.
Like, when did you call yourself an actor? Like at what point? And so
did you ever have a problem with that or no? Was it always easy for you?
Artist.
Yes.
Like, actor. I was fortunate. Sure. Like, I'm acting, motherfucker. Like, I made $320 in my first movie. But I'm
sorry.
But the term artist
is harder. Which for us, it was documentary filmmaking. It was like, what do you do?
Or it's like, are you a filmmaker? And it's like, yeah. And so I think that was the same thing. Like, are you a sannyasin? Are you spiritual? And wearing the clothes was forcing you to say, like,
I got you.
I'm a filmmaker. I'm an artist. I'm a spiritual person.
It's like it was a little bit of a fuck you to the world, but it was like taking ownership over a decision you made in your life.
Okay. The disco on the grounds of the compound. There was a disco. There was a club. Did they charge people to get into the disco?
I don't think so, no. Basically, their disco that they... Okay, so they had a couple things that were year-round, and then they had a couple things that were temporary for the World Festival that they would throw. Like, okay. They legitimately had a casino, but I'm pretty sure that casino was only a temporary casino license that they got
from
the Oregon...
They got, like, a special permit for those few weeks.
From the Oregon state government that would allow, like, legal gambling on their private property and stuff like that.
During the big celebration.
I think... Exactly. I should know this, but I think you could get... alcohol year-round on the ranch, but alcohol wasn't that big at Rosh Nishpuram. But I know in the World Festival, like it was like a party.
Looks
like
pretty
2 weeks.
Fun, huh?
The disco was hot. It was like Studio 54, Playboy Mansion. That shit looked like it was.
Yeah, it was off the hook.
They had
yeah.
the Bogwan.
I mean, cards, it was a little bit of an interesting distinction that I wish, hopefully, we like the series makes. But it takes kind of this type of talk to get it, which is. If you lived on the ranch year-round, you were one type of sannyasin, incredibly devoted and committed to the... If you were what I call like an international or global sannyasin, a lot of times you had a normal job.
You're practicing.
But it was like, come these 2 weeks in the World Festival, you're going to save up your money, you're going to go hit up Rosh Nishpuram, and you're going to go have a kick-ass 2 weeks.
I got you.
And they probably weren't as devoted to Bhagwan in the community. They were probably more normal people that just kind of had quote-unquote normal lives, normal jobs. But this was a big part of their kind of summer vacation.
One of the part of the film you guys use the clips from the ashram in Pune, very intense, looks like 16 millimeter footage. I don't remember what episode, but it's like they're in a rubber room.
Yeah,
they're naked, they're screaming, they're yelling. It's like they're fighting, they're fucking. I don't know what the fuck is going on. What footage from the ashram in Pune documentary that was used in Wild Wild Country documentary? What else is there? Because that shit looked scary.
Yeah, so what that basically was is that was a filmed representation of what they called their encounter groups. And there were these very like new age therapies taking hold in like Berkeley and the Esalen Institute and Big Sur.
It's called primal.
Primal therapy and counter therapy.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, they don't do them anymore, but in the 70s, these were popular, not just in...
You can't do that anymore.
You can't do it.
Imagine you put that on Instagram.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, this wasn't just done in the ashram. This was kind of done all over. Australia had a big primal scream therapy, and the idea was, like, you let it out, man. Like, you have a tantrum. You go physical. You fight. You know, they would get all naked and wither around together, and then at the end, you've come to this, like, eureka moment where...
Cathartic
release, you know? So very much was but like they therapeutically based. There wasn't.
Should be noted,
there was a method to the madness.
Okay.
It wasn't just.
It wasn't just beating the shit out of people.
I mean,
no, people right. got hurt. Like some people,
of
like they. It was very controversial in India, and eventually, from my thing that I heard and researched, it was one of the few times that Bhagwan and the sannyasins in general, like, kind of. Cave to the controversy in a sense of like we're not doing this anymore because we're getting too much bad press.
It's too out there
and
so
visitors
they
stopped doing it in Rosh Nishpuram, and as far as I know, and I think a lot of people will tell you this, it never happened in Rosh Nishpuram. That's why I think they were so like disappointed with that documentary that it came to Portland and showed in Portland, because it was like, yeah, this was a part of our past, but we don't do this anymore. We didn't really see the value in it so much, but it was something that stayed with them even to this day. I mean, we put it in our documentary because for Antelopians, it really was these are the new neighbors now, you know? And it was the documentary itself, not our documentary, but Ashram in Pune was such a critical document as a part of the Rosh Nish history because it kind of always tended to follow the followers no matter where they went.
Okay. For me,
yes,
the lawyer guy, Naran, he acted like all of them were just total victims. Nobody did anything wrong. And what was your takeaway from interviewing him?
Yeah.
That was one of the most... Did you shoot that with two cameras or three cameras?
Two cameras. And we'll kind of like punch in every once in a while. Okay. So it looks like it can be multiple cameras.
Okay, because it's a good-looking interview.
Yeah.
And also, like, I mean, he's an interesting character. But yeah. I was like, nothing?
Right.
Not a fucking ounce? Like, no one did anything wrong, man?
When you talk to Naran, I think he feels very strongly that obviously, like, Sheila's crimes and those within her circle are atrocious and horrible. His deep down belief is he believes that the crimes that Sheila created were a smokescreen for like
created a smoke screen.
Created a smoke screen for the government to like overreach and persecute their group and
the whole entire
the
group.
Whole entire
like one group. Bad apple
and exactly. Osho specifically. So and there's probably a legitimate argument to be made where I think the federal government and the state government knew at some point that all right, the way to deal with this whole fucking Roshnish problem, it's 2,500 people out there, is if we can just deport the guru, these people follow this guy wherever he goes. Mm. So it's kind of like, and there's a document where they said cutting off the head of the snake. I mean, that was kind of their own language that they use. So, and I think Naran feels that sincerely, that it was like, but the government, his thing is like, the government needs to be better than that. Sheila and her cohort and her crimes are one thing, but that doesn't mean that you get to attack the Pope because, you know, Catholic priests are doing shit that they're not supposed to be doing. That mm-hmm. was that not saying that I agree with that, but that was his
thing. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a total valid takeaway to say like, hey, this group that you're a part of and this leader like was somehow all this horrible shit happened because of this group. But I think for those inside the group, there's so many fractures within that community that they feel so far removed from Sheila's crimes. Like they had no idea of what was going on. And that was the experience to most of the people we talked with. If you were not part of that like 15 person circle that Sheila controlled, they were really kind of naively oblivious to what was going on. I mean, obviously they knew about the homeless people coming in and taking, but as far as the political assassinations, the poisoning.
Right, this is obviously not being talked about at the morning meditation.
They felt like Sheila and her crimes fucked us completely because we were doing nothing wrong and we were building this incredible utopia and now we're all taking the fall. And especially now they feel like their guru is somehow being associated with all this criminality, which I think it's really fascinating. What did the guru know? What didn't he know? Was Sheila taking orders? Was Sheila acting on her own? And to this
day,
I have to say my take, you know, and I watched the film twice.
Yeah.
My take was he had to know something. You know, they're having these private meetings every night up at the house. Like he has to know something.
Yeah.
You know, that was just my take. And then it's like, I'm like, when with the lawyer guy who like probably was the most frustrating one, I'm like, these things are poisoning people, assassination plots, bringing in the homeless people. Like, none of this, just all coming from this one person. Come on, I just can't believe she's not running it up the flagpole or coming up with the ideas or totally on her own. You know, is it, you know, like the Jane, you know, I was like, you know, I get his devotion, I get his sadness,
yeah.
But like, you know, like unless there was something cut out, you know, with him, I'm like, not a fucking.
Or, I mean, or just also like the president of the United States is responsible for shit that people below him do. And that's a little, it's like, if you buy into right. that
yeah,
type
I think
of level
at
of
a
responsibility,
minimum, you have to say like taking a vow of silence at the most crucial
right.
time in like your movement. Probably not like the greatest act of responsibility. Right. You know, people were looking to him for guidance. They were looking right. to him for help and he was kind of nowhere to be found. And so, but the interesting thing about what did he know, what didn't he know, when we talked to like the federal prosecutors, they were like, we couldn't find any evidence that tied him to any of this. Like, we couldn't find anything.
Even the wiretaps, because they said it was the greatest, like the
so that's what the lawyer says. That's his defense. The lawyer says, like, if they had something on those tapes, like the FBI would have released it. They would have prosecuted him. I mean, they have the 10,000 tapes. There's no way they didn't go through all these tapes. If there was something damaging on him, because they would have come out and gotten him, which is interesting, you know?
You guys talk about the tapes in the film, but you never, because I thought, oh, this is going to be a device going forward. Did you get to listen to the tapes?
We didn't. So there was a Freedom of Information Act that we filed and that was requested. But because like the participants in the wiretapping did not know that they were being recorded, the federal government is not allowed to release these tapes. And so no one's listened to
it. Oh, but they listened to it.
They said they listened to it. It's a little bit murky on whether those tapes would even be admissible in court or not. Because
but they did listen in terms of when you were just saying that
they surveilled them
quickly.
The
federal officials are very cagey. They won't tell you what's on, but they feel very confident that had this gone to a trial, we would have had the goods.
Yeah.
The other thing that was interesting was they told us is like they couldn't get anyone to flip on the guru. They're like, usually when you infiltrate these sects and these movements, there's so much resentment.
Even the mayor guy, what was his name?
They got him. That was the one guy,
but
David
Knapp.
But
he never flipped on the guru?
He didn't flip on the guru. He flipped on Sheila and, you know, saying all the stuff that Sheila did. And so that's what they're saying. Like usually these groups, there's so much resentment and regret that it's really easy to get people to flip. But these people felt like this was like the best experiment of their lives and were just not willing to give up anything.
That was a compelling dramatic moment when he flipped. And then Naran you know, it's talking about it. I mean, it's yeah. like fucking, you know, Breaking Bad or Sopranos yeah. or like, it's like this.
He
old.
Ratted, you yeah. know? I mean, it's like.
He ratted.
No one likes a rat. Even right. no matter like right. how bad things right. get, you know? Right. I'm like,
no one respects a rat.
No one likes a meditating spiritual rat either, because it's like.
Very true.
Oh, so Naran?
Yes.
Sorry. What is he? Is he still a lawyer?
He's not. He's not practicing anymore. He lives up in the Northwest. And I think, you know, for the last years, it's been really devoted. He's filed tons of Freedom of Information Acts. He has tons of legal documents that show, you know, collusion between what he believes is collusion between government agencies to kind of bend the law and get this guru out of the United States. And so he's been working on this book for a couple years, which he feels is going to be in a very explosive tell-all book of what he's uncovered in his research. And he shared a little bit of that with us in our interview. We showed some of those documents that the government was talking about at the time. But I wouldn't be surprised if he's diving in even more.
I'm sure. I mean, because, you know, now's the time.
Yeah.
When the guru was arrested and left the country, I mean, I'm gonna end this interview soon. But I mean, that whole process of like them flying him and landing him in Oklahoma City, and it made me think of Russell Westbrook,
yeah.
and you know, like that whole thing, and you know, like really sort of giving him the business. The question I have is, when he finally left Oregon, what happens to the ranch? Like, how quick did people leave, and how quick did it go to be, you know, like sort of unfunctioning?
Yeah.
And who owned it?
Sure. So they had within, once the guru was arrested, he ends up taking a plea deal and agrees to leave the country. And I believe it was within weeks to a month, people started filing out of there. I mean, their main purpose for being there was to hear him speak, to be around his enlightened presence. And so it became very clear that they could not sustain that community financially without the guru there. And so they had many different corporations that they set up. I think it was like Rajneesh Foundation International, and they had a separate LLC that owned the ranch, a separate LLC that did all the book sales, a separate LLC that owned all the Rolls Royces. So it was very like financially complex how they set up their financial structure. But eventually, they wanted to sell the entire ranch. They couldn't really find anyone to pay what they wanted for it. There was some talk of them turning it into a prison out there for a while, the state was looking at.
Yeah. And they would have loved the Antelopians would have loved the ranch.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, basically, the insurance company that was given the mortgage to the Rajneeshis ends up taking it over, and they end up selling it to Dennis Washington, who's like this Montana billionaire who's made his money and kind of trains and not oil, but steel, I think, in Montana. And Dennis, I think, was very interested in the ranch because one of the unique things is that the Rajneeshis won on land use and their incorporation always remained intact. They lost on church state, which was in the courts. They lost ultimately saying that they did violate the separation of church and state. But on land use, they won at the Oregon Supreme Court. So Dennis Washington, I think, was interested in owning this piece of property that had an incorporated city attached to it. He kind of ran into some of his development problems. I think he had bigger plans to do with it. And then ultimately, after like a year or two, ends up gifting it to Young Life, which is kind of this youth Christian group that owns it today and are the current tenants.
Did you guys go up there?
Yeah, we did.
We filmed a little bit. Like when you see some like the broken down A-frames and stuff, that's still on the property up there in the hills.
Were you, when you guys have finally got up there, like were you tripping out like, oh shit? Like
it's really gnarly when you get out there. They still have the airport strip out there, and the downtown mall that they built is still built, and it's striking just how much in the middle of nowhere you are. I mean, you're just surrounded by vast, vast mountains. And there's definitely like, I'm not a spiritual person, but there's some energy that you get out there that's like, man, we're in the middle of nowhere. And this is a little bit weird, to be honest, you know. And it's just seeing the remnants of the city. You'll see little things here and there that, you know, were built by the Rajneeshis.
Is there a Starbucks in Antelope now?
There's no Starbucks now.
No, okay. There's nothing. Okay.
It's like, yeah. I mean, right. They claim it never really recovered, you know? I mean,
right.
Now it's down and out. I mean, I know it sounds horrible, but it's kind of like, well, probably a little bit drug infested. It looks like they have meth issues. And, you know, it's become a town that's, you know,
struggling like the rest of kind of small towns in America.
Exactly. All right, listen, My final question. Do you guys have any idea what you're going to do next? I know it's probably a shitty question, especially after you come off of something that's got such a passionate following. Do you know what you're going to do?
We do. We're in development on two different documentary series that I think we're going to try and do kind of at the same time that we're also teaming up with Mark and Jay Duplass on. And we're just not talking about it yet because we're still getting the characters on board. But one is like an entirely different story than Wild Wild Country. And then I think one will be kind of a similar in-depth deep dive into culture, politics, power, art, something a little bit
it's
more.
It's interesting because I think that like we wanted to do the story of Rajneesh Purim as a documentary series because it was great to the story. And I think that now we've become attracted to stories that we could tell again in a documentary series format. It's just such a bigger canvas and you're able to play with so much more room and space. And like in Wild Wild Country, we got to tell a Nike story and we got to tell like a whole bunch of stuff that seemingly isn't related, but you get to kind of work in and tell a bigger story. So we're really excited about Doc Series.
You get a platform like this, people who feel like they have a story that they want to tell, it becomes a more viable opportunity. And so it's been interesting since the release that, you know, we are starting to talk to characters that feel like we have information to divulge on these new stories that we're doing, which is really exciting to
us.
Just
got to get more on board.
The guy, what's his name? The Nike?
Bowerman.
Bill Bowerman.
Like, did you ask him, like, to hook you up with, like, some, like, rare Jordans? Like, does he have that kind of hookup? Is he fucking rich out of his, like, his father?
I don't think so.
His father created Nike.
Co-founded Nike.
He invented the shoe. Bill Bowerman created the waffle shoe, the running shoe, you know, and then teamed up with Phil Knight.
Apparently.
But, like, in his crib, is there, like, fucking Nikes and, like, Jordans?
They have a lot of history, and his wife actually found the original waffle iron that they made the first Nike shoe on, which Nike now owns, I think, in their Portland headquarters or Seattle headquarters. But no, apparently Bowerman will be the first to tell you. Apparently he sold stock too early. So
I got you. All right, well, listen, I can't tell you how much of an accomplishment it is that you made this film. So many more people are going to see it. So congratulations. I loved it. I'm obsessed with it. I highly encourage everybody. I'm nonstop talking about Wild Wild Country.
Thank you
so much. Congratulations. It was dope.
This was a great talk. Thanks for having us on. We love talking about it.
Thank you so much for coming. Because like I said at the beginning, to be so excited about something than to have you guys here, it's just like cool. Because like, you know, it's the power of sort of social media. So absolutely. Sincere congratulations and good luck on the rest
of
your
stuff. Thanks so much. Thanks for having us.